Welcome this morning. Oops, it's not makes nice noises. Now it's not really solid. On the other hand, okay. So last time we looked at yesterday. We looked at fold and map and filter, and we noticed that compositions of these operations could be kind of condensed into a single application of the fold. And then we, in the end, found... So this operation allowed us to remove intermediate data structures, which would otherwise have been built up after every application of a function, of these list functions. Now then, we in the very end, we notice that if the base list, so to speak, where this sequence of maps and filters and folds eventually would be applied to, if that list is originates from the tabling of a function by means of this tabulate, then we could even avoid to build up the list right from scratch and have enter a loop which simply operates on repeatedly generates elements and folds them into an accumulator, which in the end is produced, and that is by means of this loop function. This is a tail recursive function. This is really a loop. So this is the optimal thing what we might hope for a functional program to be equivalent to. Now, that was kind of the end of what we had did last time. And that was later. One might think, wonder, okay, this mapping and filtering and folding, they are nice, but there are other functions, higher order functions of list transforming functions which are around, and we might think of wonder how they may relate to the other functions. And so the one natural thing is so one nuisance with lists is that you have an ordering, a fixed ordering, and the folding kind of reverses the ordering in some sense. Reverses the ordering. So one might wonder, what about list reverse? So here is the reverse function, and what is that noise from? One observation is that one can define this reverse by means of a tail recursive helper function. This is this ref prime, and this ref prime has an accumulating parameter and takes additionally a list, and then kind of adds recurses over the argument and takes over the argument list, and then just takes the elements from that argument and puts it onto the accumulator, and by that reverses the list. So in some sense, this is ref prime could also be expressed. So this is kind of an exercise by means of fold left, namely ref prime
we can eliminate. So the ref prime is fold left with which function? The function is fun. It takes the accumulator, it takes an x, and puts x in front of the accumulator. And that's it. That is the ref prime.
So in that sense, this ref prime is itself is expressed by means of the fold, but with a very specific function, and it takes a list and returns a list. So, and then there is one more thing which one notes, one property which is which one might want to, which we are convinced that it holds. I think I closed the door. I think this makes me nervous. So let me kind of beautify a little bit the slides. So this is now nicer to read. Okay. So then the other thing is that ref is a nice function because it's its own reverse. So if you apply it twice, then you get the identity. And then there is, and then there might be something else. So if you have a binary function, then there's something like a swap operation, and so what is the swap operation? It takes a binary function and returns a binary function, but with arguments reversed. So, and again, applying swap twice would result in the identity. And then the interesting thing is, and that is useful to note, that there is, this is also, if you like, kind of an optimization. There is this fold right operation, which is also quite popular in functional programming. And the fold right operation, it takes it like the fold left operation, adds the elements onto or combines the elements of a list successively into the accumulator using a combine function, but the fold right does it in a different way. So the fold right does not start on the left end of the list and puts that onto the accumulator, but it starts at the right end. And that's something, so in that sense, it's kind of order preserving. If you kind of, if you use fold right in a similar sense as we have done it for the computing this ref prime, then this fold right would return the identity on the list. So therefore, but on the other hand, this fold right now, and it has the definition of the fold right is not tail recursive. So fold right is here is how fold right is just for as an exercise, and fold right. I think in OCaml you would write it function, so this means pattern matching on the next argument. Fold right. Ah, no, they write it differently, sorry. Fold right. Yeah, fold right. Okay, so no, you could do it like that. So then you would do it like, if it's the empty list, then you return A. And otherwise, you apply F to the fold right. Ah, sorry. What do I write here? Let me kind of. So I make. It's like that, and the alternative is that the argument has the form XXS, and then you apply F to X, and what you obtain by folding F A to XS.
Yeah. So in that sense, the F kind of replaces the constructor in the list constructor with a function, and the A replaces the empty list, and by that you kind of map the function into the list into an expression whose evaluation is the result. So this is how the fold write is implemented, and now you see here that is not a tail recursive function. So this, and that kind of means you have to the stack grows during the evaluation, and you might wonder whether you could kind of improve on that by using kind of not using the kind of shrinking the stack and kind of doing decomposing this fold write into a series of tail recursive functions. And that is exactly what's going on here in this kind of equation. Here on the right, you have a composition of two functions, namely this fold write, and here this ref. And ref is a tail recursive, can be implemented in a tail recursive way, and this fold left also can be implemented in a tail recursive way. So that means in this, you twice iterate over something in a tail recursive manner, and that means the stack space, the stack consumption goes to constant instead of linear in the fold write. So that, therefore, this kind of transformation, from the red to the green might be considered advantages in some application. There is a kind of a flaw in this argument that a kind of flaw occurs here because the argument list first must be reversed. And that kind of takes the original list and returns another list. So you save the stack space, but you produce heap space. So in that sense, this transformation from red to green might be stupid if considered in isolation. But if it is just one transformation in a series of other transformations, it might happen that the reverse to the very right might be swallowed by some other operation, and by that go away, and then one could remove this intermediate list, perhaps. So this is, for example, if you we may consider sequences of transformations of lists where in between there are reverses. So, for example, we could have something like a ref after a map. Okay, so then we could kind of exchange the map and the ref. We could have a ref and a filter so that these again can be exchanged. And there is kind of, now that means thinking again that in the end we have this fold write. Then here we could kind of decompose it into a fold left and a ref. And if we then have to the right of the fold write a series of map transformations, we can push the ref maximally to the right. And hopefully in the end we arrive with the ref at another ref where it is kind of is vaporized, or it hits a tabulate, and when it hits a tabulate, well then it means you simply have to you have to kind of do a reverse tabulation, because whether you kind of start your tabulation with a zero and go to n, you could also do it starting with n and going to zero. So that in that sense, and this ref tabulate, either whether you start with tabulate or with ref tabulate does not make a big difference. You can this ref tabulate also can kind of then can be fused with maps, and can be fused also with a fold left, namely into, but then now into a loop
where iteration goes in the opposite direction. So it's no longer that you start from zero to n, but you start from n and go to zero. So in that sense, so that was the ref. So in that sense, this is we could consider it as a useful extension, as it allows us to use fold right instead of fold left for our combination of elements in a list. But then now, if we might get more and more ambitious. And so the next extension, which is no longer so standard as the kind of family of functions which we have looked at so far, is that if there's a dependence on the index. So that is not so typically, so doing a map over a list means simply we are ignorant where an element is positioned in a list. So it doesn't matter for us. But sometimes it matters. So because the first element should be treated differently from the second element. And that is kind of, there is an index dependence in the function. So this is this map I. So this map I is a function which takes, it starts at zero. If the first element is transformed, there's not f applied to it, but f receives the function which is applied to the element, receives another argument which is the index. So therefore, this map I therefore applies f0 to the element at the first position, and f1 to the next, and f2 to the next, and so on. So this means different functions are applied to the elements. So this is this map I. And now we might wonder what happens if, and the same, a similar variation of the fold could be thought of, namely that the folding kind of it depends on the index, so that you use a different function for folding the first element and for the second and so on, and or put it differently, that you have that this function f takes now three arguments, the index, the accumulator, and the x. And and uses these three arguments to compute the new accumulator. So that would be this fold left indexed, this EI for index dependency. Yeah. And now we have, we get a new family of, if you like, a new family of transformations of lists, namely these map I's and these fold left I's, and we may again wonder, can they be meaningfully composed and intermediate lists be eliminated? And as you have might guessed, yes, it is possible. So we need a few more composition functions, which I have listed here. I guess it is... all these composition functions kind of take into account the index. So that's this. And then, so what we find is, for example, here let us look at some of these rules. In some sense, they are easily, we easily would believe these. And you can perhaps come up with such kind of rules by yourself easily. So for the first thing is, if you have a map I, F, and after a map G, then clearly you can compose them also, because the second is index dependent, the first one is not, but still you can compose them into one index dependent function, which is happens here. And the same goes in the opposite direction. So if you have an index-independent function following an index-dependent function, which you want to map over a list, then you can also compose them together into an index-depending function. And likewise, you can, if you, I guess, two map I's together. Where is that? A map I, yeah, that's the next one. So in some sense, this is the center of all these function compositions. Rules, this one, if you have two index-dependent functions, which you
want in sequence to be mapped over a list, then you can compose them and also map them jointly. And you see here, in all these cases, you need different composition functions, which I have defined on the slide before, but we may look at the definition, but somehow the intuition is clear, and also how these composed functions are have to be defined, and so therefore I will not look at the definition of these functions. So that is for the composition of index-dependent composition, and then there is also something like then we might wonder what happens if you have an index-dependent fold left. Will that compose with a map? And the answer, what you have guessed, is yes. You only have to change your the function which you use for combination, and you may also an index-independent fold left can also be combined with a index-dependent map. The result then will be again index-dependent, and you have to use a specific composition of the two functions. And the same thing happened, and now the core rule is again this one: if both the folding and the mapping is index-dependent, then you can, then there is a composition, and so that you can jointly fold index dependently the result over the list. Yeah, so that's kind of what you so you should get the gist out of it, how it works. So it's always the same idea, and now only extended with this indexing. And the same thing holds now if you kind of, and if you have this index dependent folding and want to combine it with a tabulate, then this is also possible. And one might even think of index depending mapping and tabulating can also be combined, but I think I have not this kind of rule I have omitted here, but that is even more natural. Yeah. This goes through smoothly, but there is a little bit of a catch. You must be careful. Not everything is possible. So if you have index dependence, then certain things will not work. So, for example, the reversing and the filtering do not go well, because if you are index dependent, you cannot kind of revert, because then the indices would also have to be transformed. And and then the other thing is, if we want to apply this kind of transformation, so these rules like these look nicely, but we kind of assume that this particular word and that particular word have a particular meaning, that they denote exactly those functions which we have defined by fold left and which we have defined by map, by index dependent map. So, but in functional programming, a name can be redefined all the time. So that is, you have to make sure that these names are not just names, but that they have a semantics, so that they are really defined by these functions and not by something different. And that means you can apply these transformations in some sense only if the user uses functions from the from some kind of standard library, and only these, and not his own definition of map. That would not be possible by the compiler to check whether an own definition of a map is the same as the standard library map semantically. Besides, it's certain syntactic variations could perhaps be tolerated, but otherwise one would not be able to do that. And that means that also Haskell, for example, provides a particular library where the user can build on, or can assume that these kind of rules are applied, and so he's forced to use these functions and this library, and only then the transformations will take place. In some sense, therefore, these transformations are nice, but a bit limited in their potential applicability. So that is on the, so this is on the negative side. On the positive side is that these rules, in some sense, and or people have looked at these type of rules and observed that they kind of follow a general scheme which is not bound, not restricted to lists. In some sense, you can apply similar optimization techniques for any tree-like data structure. The only things is that this tree-like, well, if you have a tree-like data structure, then you have kind of constructors, and then somewhere these alphas or data values. And then you can define in this, and you always, there is something like a map. Because this means you replace the data values by something else. And there's always something like a fold. That means you kind of collect all the data values in your data structure in the ordering in which they are there and apply them to accumulate them into an accumulator. And that the same is index depending. Also the index dependent variants of these functions are always available in these kind of data structures. And also then these data structures typically support something like a to list or a from list. So you can transform it into a list or you can transform it from a list. So here is one example of such a tree-like data structure. So it's just, so you have an empty leaf and then every node has bears an element from type alpha. And yeah, so please note that this kind of type declaration is a little bit, it's a little bit stylized. It's not the perfect OCaml syntax, because in OCaml, for example, you would kind of put the type parameter to the left. But I guess in, and I think you have also to add there something like node of. And then you cannot kind of list these arguments, but you must be, so constructors are applied to tuples. But here, I think this is more in the Haskell style. In the Haskell style, nodes are functions, constructors are functions, and so you can put several arguments. And you also put the parameters to the right and not to the left. So in that sense, it is more, the type declaration is more Haskell-like, while the syntax for the functions, for the program itself, is more in the style of OCaml. It's a mixture. So as usual in these, so yeah. Okay, so now, so here is, so we have this tree data structure. Now how would the map be defined? So it would be a recursive function, and it would be, if it's a leaf, then you return the leaf, and if it's a node, then you map the function f over the left subtree, over the right subtree, and then apply it, additionally apply f to the element in the node, and then you construct from these three pieces the transformed element in the node, the transformed left, the transformed right subtree, join them together, and that's the new node. Yeah. So that's the map. And the fold, in some sense, is similar. So what would folding mean? Fold left now here means that you first fold the left subtree into, so as I have done it here in that way, that you first fold the left subtree into onto the accumulator. This happens here. Then you apply f to the result, and then you fold f over the right subtree. So in this sense, this is like the fold left in lists. So you start to the left of the data structure and put it onto the accumulator. Note that now in a tree-like data structure, this fold left is no longer a tail. You need two recursive calls to the fold left. Here is the first recursive call, here is the second recursive call. And if you have two calls which are applied in a row, not both of them can be tail recursive. So there's only always one last call. So that means the first one is not tail recursive, but the second one is. So that's perhaps a side remark. And here are other functions like this toList function. So the toList can be considered as... So I have not expressed the toList by means of the fold left, because fold left would reverse the ordering, but it is kind of so one might define it by a one might define this toList also now again a kind of programming exercise as the composition of ref and fold left, fold left. Now, which function you take the accumulator and the x and return the list x a. And then you start with the empty list. Yeah. And so in this way, you kind of can decompose this toList function into a fold left and a reverse, if you like, a list reverse. And now the from list. The from list is, if you like, something like a... So that's a little bit of a problem. By default, the transformation from a tree into a list is more or less canonical if you kind of want to preserve the left to right ordering of elements. But in the opposite direction, it's a little bit more complete. There's some loss of information because the tree structure, there are multiple tree structures which could represent the same list. So here, therefore, therefore the list which, is the tree which is constructed here from a list is a very stupid tree. It looks like that. It takes produces a series of nodes where to the left are always leaves, and here is also a leaf, and then the axis. The elements here are put into the nodes. Yeah? So it's kind of a tree representation of a list. If our tree data structure is something more special, not any tree, but kind of a balanced tree or something, then this from list operation will not suffice. Then we would need some extra balancing operation. Okay. And now we might start to write down equations to possibly remove intermediate trees. And so, for example, what we kind of find immediately is that if we construct a tree from a list and then map again to a list, then this is the identity, and so that can be removed. But if we first go to the list and then reconstruct from the list, then this typically will not be the same tree. So in that sense, this is a kind of a rule which cannot be applied. Or if we map, but there's another thing, if we have to map a function over a tree, and then we go to the list, we could also first go to the list and then map the F. So in that sense, sometimes these trees are overrated. If sometimes we think list is a stupid data structure, we construct a tree and then do everything with the tree. But if we just want to map and in the end fold, then we notice that this we could do as well over lists. So that is kind of one way of replacing one complicated data structure by a simpler data structure. Namely, if in the end we are interested in only in a list, then we can go to the list first and map then. And the same holds, and if we, yeah. Yeah. So I don't know whether that kind of is, that is an interesting rule, maybe not so much, but at least it holds. I don't know whether we will apply it, but then these rules may be again, at least, so then that rule here is again interesting. It means if in the end we want to fold, and we have worked with a tree, and then we thought, we go to the list and then use the list fold, and that is kind of perhaps a stupid idea, then we could do the fold also directly over the tree. And then there's another thing, if we want to, instead of, when we think that folding over the tree might be better than folding over the list, so going from a list to a tree and folding then can also be simplified to folding directly over the list. So these kind of rules can again be applied to simplify to simplify sequences of transformations of such trees, and that kind of, and we could transform one tree of one type into a tree of another type, and so on, and by that and then use similar ideas to avoid the generation of intermediate tree structures. Okay. So now there is even a, so there is all, even in this tree, there is kind of a reverse, which also might be taken into account in the series of transformations of trees. But I think this is only a programming exercise. So let's therefore stop with this kind of transformations. And so once again, so these kind of rules might be difficult to apply. They are easier to apply when these maps and folds are not implemented by the user, and that is now it gives a further perspective to programming and to compilation, because modern so one of the I would say most hated parts in programming is that you have to do the same and the same again and again. So, for example, you define a new data type, and then you define a map for the data type, and then you find a define a fold for the data type. And so there's something like generic or metaprogramming that you say, okay, I define the type, and all the routine functions are then generated by some kind of, in an automatic way. And then you can, so that means whenever you define a function, you automatically have a map and a fold. And there are other automatic functions who could be automatically generated, for example, a toString method or a hash function and so on. So if you have such an environment, then these functions like this map and fold for a particular type, they are not user-defined, and so you know the algebraic properties, and then you can apply these transformations. And in that sense, then these transformation rules again become very interesting and realistic to be applied. And in fact, I must say, Ralf Vogler, he used kind of OCaml for our program analyzer, and there's a lot of boilerplate code in it. So a lot of standard functions which are routinely defined for all kinds of data types. And so he's very enthusiastic about such kind of things of metaprogramming, and he by that tries to remove a lot of repetition in the implementation. And so that would be helpful there. Now let us turn to another very subtle point when compiling functional languages, and namely that is the question whether what is the semantics of a functional program. So you know there is this world of Haskell and there is the world of OCaml. And both are functional languages, but they have a major, there's one major point where they differ, and that is in the order in which arguments are evaluated. So Haskell has this lazy evaluation or call by need evaluation, and that means an argument is not immediately evaluated before passing to a function as an argument, but only when it is accessed. And also, if you have a let, then this does not mean that the right hand side of a let will automatically be evaluated, but only when the corresponding left hand side is ever queried by the accessed. The value of the left hand side is asked, is queried. And now one might wonder, why should one use this delayed evaluation, if you like, or this call by need evaluation? And because typically we think if we pass a parameter, then we pass it to a function because we think that the function will need it. And so the case that it is not needed should not occur. But this is not true because there are application, a particular, if you like, algorithmic patterns where it is quite elegant to have to delay the evaluation and only evaluate expressions when needed. And that is that one can now deal with data structures which conceptually represent infinite lists. Now, clearly, an infinite list you will never be able to spell out in totality, but you may define this infinite list, and then this kind of by means of a generator function, and then you might have a producer function, and then you might have a consumer function. You pass this infinite list into a consumer, and the consumer then decides how much of the infinite list it really will look at. So it might, for example, it might require a number of primes. But so for defining the list of all primes, you might do once for all. So why should you only produce 5 primes? Yeah, so you produce all primes, you return them in a list, and then it is up to the consumer to decide how many primes it really needs. So in that sense, this is an elegant concept, but it comes at a price. And the price is that delaying the evaluation of expressions by default means that whenever you have an expression, so like x plus 1, you will not evaluate x plus 1, but you construct a closure for x plus 1. So here is, for example, a little bit of an example. So here you have this function from, which takes an n and returns not the list of numbers up to n, but the list of numbers from n. So it returns n, n plus 1, and so on. And now then you may define this function take, which takes as an argument, the first argument, a number, and as a second argument, a stream, which is a possibly infinite sequence of numbers, and then, or of elements. And then, well, if k equals 0 or less, then it returns the empty list. And otherwise, if the stream is empty, then it returns the empty stream. And otherwise, it takes the first element and continues with taking k minus 1 elements from the rest. So with that definition, this take function can deal very nicely with finite or with infinite lists. and cut off at most k elements from the argument. Yeah. So therefore, this kind of take 5 from 0 would then result in the first 5 elements of the stream from 0. And that would be would work fine. In Haskell, it would kind of be a disaster in OCaml, because before taking 5, the first OCaml would try to build up the list of all numbers starting at 0, and that would kind of, so would not terminate. Okay? So that is the one thing. So that means here we gain expressiveness by call by need, but we lose efficiency. As I said, we have to build up closures for everything. So take a look at a very stupid example. It is really a stupid example, but it kind of illustrates the situation quite nicely. This factorial function with an accumulating parameter. So A is the accumulating parameter, X is the real argument. So if X is less or equal to 0, then you kind of return the accumulating parameter. Otherwise, you decrement the X, and you multiply X with... So first multiply X onto the accumulating parameter, and then you decrement X and pass it to the tail recursive call of the factorial function. Now, what happens if you have a call by need environment? That means you kind of, you construct a closure for X minus 1, you construct a closure for A times X and pass it to the recursive call. So then the factorial 2, the recursive call, will have to check whether the first argument is less or equal to 0. So therefore the X minus 1, this one here, will immediately be evaluated. The closure will be unpacked, if you like, evaluated, and evaluated well to a value. But that one will never be evaluated. So it will just be a closure, and it remains a closure. And then a new closure will be constructed for X minus 1 times X times A. And a new so all the multiplications on the accumulator will not be evaluated. So always there will be kind of, a stack of closures. So the huge... So this means this factorial 2 will be tail. It will have no stack consumption, but it will have a huge heap consumption, because it will construct the whole heap, the whole kind of a very huge arithmetic expression inside the heap. And only when the factorial function, the value of the factorial function later on is queried, then all these nested closures will by and by be evaluated, and then you return the value. Okay? So this makes it makes it a nuisance. So so that is what I try to explain. All these multiplications will be delayed, and that means that the accumulating parameter will consist of nested closures, and only when the value is accessed, this dynamic data structure is then evaluated. But the point is that the cost of computing A times X is the same or even less than computing the closure for A times X. So, and also the termination behavior will be, there is kind of a problem. So the question is whether the value which is provided is I think there's no the termination behavior is not different. So in that sense, there is no point in constructing the closures. It's only overhead and no gain. So that means what we would like to have is that the accumulating parameter should have been passed directly by value. And the question is, so we would kind of, so So now the question. So now we would like to design an optimization which allows us to do such kind of transformations. That is, we want to replace a call by. We want to force an expression to be evaluated. So that is kind of needs an extension of the language, kind of a force operator, which says, please evaluate this expression. So, and now in order to do that, to do this kind of forcing and transformation and analysis, which we might require for doing such kind of optimization, we kind of simplify our language. We do it for even more simple language, and that means we for the moment do not consider any data structures, no higher order functions, and no local function definitions. So very simple. And then, then we have this unary operator, which forces the evaluation of a variable. That means please evaluate that variable. And the goal is to place this hash at as many places as possible. So here is now our favorite language. And so we have here this expression. Oh, sorry. Now here is our super duper expression language. It's the same as you might have expected. So functions are applied to expressions. Then you have operator applications. You have constants. You have if then else, and you have this let. But this let only should introduce values and not functions. And then we have, and then the only thing what we kind of modify is in the let, we kind of will say, please evaluate this variable x, and by placing a hash at that variable. And and then we have function definitions. A function definition is the same as before. The function definition says, please apply f to the arguments. And then we will have and overall the program is a collection of recursive function definitions, which are then used in the main expression E. So that's our little language. So now only integers, no data, no lists, no tuples, no nothing. And now the question is, we would like to kind of analyze such kind of programs in order to detect which parameters can be evaluated to a value before we pass it to a function. And for that, we kind of use an abstraction of values. An abstraction, and that is a 0-1 abstraction. So 0 means that the evaluation does definitely not terminate. So that means we have an expression formally returning an int, but we know definitely that this, or we assume that this function, this expression will not terminate. So it's like x equals x. Yeah, so that would not terminate. And so 1 means the evaluation may terminate. So clearly it is safe to annotate every variable with 1, because that means everything may terminate. Now, what is the significance of the 0 and 1? The significance is, the interesting thing is, when you pass it to a function. So if you have a function and you pass a 0 to it and it returns 0, so what does it mean? This means that the function will not terminate whenever the argument does not terminate. So this means it definitely consumes this argument. It depends on that argument. If it may return, if it may terminate without, although the argument is not terminating, then it means the function may look at the argument or may not look at the argument. But when it definitely will not terminate, when the argument does not terminate, then this function is will definitely depend on that argument. And that means, and that is the interesting information. So in that sense, so if f applied to 0 returns 0, then we call f strict. And, So that means we try to determine the abstract semantics of all functions. So that is, we want to know for which argument, see, if I assign 0, 1, 0, 1 to the arguments, will the function terminate or will it not terminate? And how can we do it? So, so that is, a function has a value. Here is it, a function has that value. For each argument, we have 0 or 1, and the result is 0 or 1. Now, in order to determine that value for a function, we have to abstractly evaluate the body of that function, and that is an expression E. And the expression E now may have occurrences of the parameters of the function F. And so the body of the function is evaluated, must be evaluated with respect to an abstract environment, mapping the variables to values. So that is, we need such kind of an abstract evaluation function for the body of functions. And that, so E now has parameters. So this means are global variables, which are the parameters of the function. And for these we have values in B, and we now want to evaluate the expression to some value. So it's like the ordinary expression evaluation, which we had over the integers, for example, for constant propagation, only that now we evaluate everything over 0, 1. So now a constant, if we evaluate a constant over, then we will find, so that definitely terminates, so this is 1. So then if you evaluate a variable, then that's the value of the variable is given by the row, by the abstract environment. If we do a unary if we apply a unary operator like a minus or something, then this is will terminate if and only if the argument terminates. So therefore it is like that. Now if I have an arithmetic operation like a plus or a multiplication, then we say, then it's clear, this plus will terminate if the two arguments have terminated, because the extra computation introduced by addition will not fail. So therefore, this operator, this binary operator, therefore is mapped to the conjunction. And so that was kind of routine, and now an interesting point is the if then else. Because if then else, so it has three sub-expressions, the condition E0, the then part E1, and the else part E2. And it's not the case that all three parts always will be evaluated. The only thing what we can be sure of is that the condition E0 will be evaluated. From the others, we only need know that one of them will be evaluated. So therefore, the choice between the alternatives is kind of mapped to an OR, and otherwise we have here an AND with a condition. So that is kind of, and now we may wonder, can we improve on that? Well, could we somehow determine statically, well, we could improve on that if we were able to statically determine whether the condition evaluates to true or false. But that we cannot do with this domain, because this cannot be expressed in that domain. If we had a domain at hand which is able to express that, then we might go beyond that. But typically, so here we cannot. Okay. So that's for the if then else, which is in that sense the only interesting function here. And then if now what happens if we have a function application? So f is applied to e1 to ek. So now this f, so actually this abstract evaluation we kind of used for determining the value of a function, because it's the body of the function. And that means we have kind of, it allows us to build up a constraint system or an equation system which determines those values of f. And so if we take here, if we have in the expression e, we hit at the function application, we take the current value of the function and apply it to the values returned for the arguments. And then hopefully by fixed point iteration, we get these red values f. Okay, so then we had something more, that was the let and this let sharp. So what is the let? So that the let is, what would we do there? Okay, so that means we would not evaluate the E1 first, but that the value of the let is the value of the main body, but now in the, of the main expression E, but the E may have contained the extra variable X1. And for X1, which value should we choose for X1? Well, the value which we obtain by evaluating the right-hand side of X1. So we extend the row by something, and that is the new new environment within which we evaluate the E. Okay, so that is how we deal with the let. Now, what is with the? Now that was kind of, in some sense, the natural thing to do. Now, what happens if we kind of if we have a let sharp? And so in let, that means that the E1, that we claim that the E1 must be evaluated. So that is, and so the E1 must be evaluated. So if the E1 will not terminate, the whole thing will not terminate. And also, the X, if it terminates, so if it's zero, then the whole thing is zero. That is done by this. This is accounted for by the conjunction. And if it's not zero, then we know that the E1 has been evaluated, and therefore we can set E1 to 1, and then evaluate E with that extra assumption information. Okay? So that is how we deal with the let and the let sharp. Okay? And now... And then what we do, we put up a system of equations. I already mentioned that, and that looks as follows. We want for the fi, we want to determine these functions for all, so assume that f1 to fn are the functions which are defined by our program. Each of them, for each of them, we have to determine a function, namely, what is the result value when we apply the function to B1 to every possible combination of booleans? So that means we have this kind of equation system. Yeah. So once again, the unknowns of these equation systems are these transformations f for the fi, and the individual entries of these functions are these applied to B1 to BK. And so the result there for this thing here should be a Boolean. And then the other thing is, what we note is that whenever we kind of fix the B1 to BK to Boolean values, so to zeros or ones, then the value returned by the right-hand side is monotonic somehow. You can spell it out symbolically by conjunction and disjunction. There's no negation involved. And therefore, this is a monotonic functions. The right-hand side is a monotonic functions in the B's. And that means that the whole thing is monotonic. That is that we get the least solution for this equation system. And Yeah, and then we can effectively compute it. We simply do the iteration until everything is finite here, until the everything converges. There's a little bit of a catch here, and that is that there are many monotonic functions. So if you have k arguments, you have 2 to the 2 to the k monotonic functions. Or put it differently, the height of the lattice is 2 to the k. And that means why? Each such function has k arguments. So it could, the smallest function is that for every tuple, for every k tuple, it returns 0. The largest element is that for every tuple, it returns 1. Since there are exponentially many tuples, in each of them, you can decide to switch from 0 to 1. You obtain something which is exponential in height. You can think of it to refer to unknowns of that form, or to you combine all of them together to unknowns of that form, and in each case it's monotonic. Yes. So let us consider our factorial function with 2 arguments and see what we find for that. And now clearly, so here in reality, so it's exponential. That is kind of, there are 2 things to say. Yes, it is exponential, and we have to think about it. And the second thing is, it's only exponential in the number of arguments. And now if you think of how many arguments would a usual programmer use, and then the functions which one has is, that do we use functions with 32 arguments? And the answer is no, we typically do not. So our functions have 2, 3, 4, 5 arguments, that's it. And with 5, 2 to the power of 5 is... 32, and that's still nothing. So yeah. So in that sense, we should not be too afraid of the height of the lattice. And then also, it is, as we have noted, that fixed point iteration will not traverse all. If you have even a lattice of great height. Then it would not kind of go step by step, but it would make larger jumps, and so one might hope that fixed point iteration still may terminate more quickly. There's another point that if you have many arguments, the tables for to write down the functions, like for example to write down the abstract function. The Boolean function for factorial 2 might be large, because even if you have 32 arguments, then you have to spell out, if you have 5 arguments, then you have to spell out this large table with 32 entries. And so on the slide, I kind of have only 2 arguments here in the example, but still I'm too lazy to spell out the table for these 2 arguments. I prefer to write a symbolic expression for it. Yeah, so I use the B1 and B2 as Boolean variables, and then write down the Boolean expression for the right-hand side. So let us again look at the function. Where is it? Here. At the the Boolean function. What is it? So x is. So let's see. So this one. Accounts for x and then the result is A, so A is A, or the factorial applied to, well, x minus 1 is x, and A times A is x and A. Yeah, and here I have used the same form, the same parameters as the function has, but here in that I applied it to B1 and B2, but that kind of means only a renaming of the parameters, if you like. But here is exactly the expression which I have kind of... You see, that expression you can obtain very quickly from the syntax. And then you kind of can use this expression to kind of try to... do a fixed point computation. So that is, we might kind of start with the least expression. So here is the least function with two arguments. The least function with two arguments is the constant zero function. Yeah? Then you, this is a constant, so that function you plug in into that expression, you evaluate it. You simplify. So that means this function here is zero, and that is you check what is the resulting function. So it is B1 and B2 or zero. B2 or zero is B2, so it's B1 and B2. This gives us the next iteration. And then now you have seen how I do this thing. So the next step is that I replace factorial of 2 with this function a, x and a. So this is then b1 and b1 and b2. So this is b1 and b2. Yeah? So we obtain the same function again. So that is, the fixed point has been reached. Yeah, so what do we see? What do we learn from it? So that means the abstract description of the factorial 2 function is the conjunction of the arguments. So when any of the arguments is zero, the result is zero. So this function, therefore, is strict in each argument. So therefore, yeah, so that is what we learn. The factorial 2 function is strict in both arguments. It is... This means that the evaluation terminates, then also the evaluation of its arguments. So this means we may, whenever we arrive at a factorial 2, call to factorial 2, we beforehand may evaluate the actual parameters. So that is, we may transform it in such a way that we here explicitly evaluate the actual parameters before calling factorial 2. That is, we would not build up the closures for the factorial 2. Okay, now that's, I hope you got the idea and you noted that although our analysis seemed to be quite trivial, so we ignored the ifs and elses. And so it appeared to be, it seemed as if it were quite trivial, but it was not so trivial, and it allowed us to amazingly, it allowed us to infer the strictness properties which we wanted to have. Now the problem, there are now several questions. So the first question is, how do we define the correctness of that analysis? So what we wrote down was kind of a fixed point equation to get the abstract description of the functions. And that was the key point. And now the question is, how can we prove this abstract equation system correct? And the best thing is if the concrete semantics has the same form as the abstract semantics. So it should also be in form of such a fixed point equation. And there is a formulation of the semantics of in particular functional programs by means of such fixed point equations, and that is denotational semantics. So denotational semantics means to every function you assign a denotation, and the denotation is kind of, well, So a function is a transformation, takes the arguments, returns the values, and that you, this function you try to formalize. And that is denotational semantics. And so it's different from the operational semantics, because operational semantics kind of tries to formalize the steps in which a result is computed. So the steps of the computation. So that we did for imperative programs. So we, it was small step, because if every individual step was kind of modeled by the semantics, while here this denotational semantics does not care about how the results are computed. It only cares about the results and whether they are computed at all. And therefore, it is kind of, in some sense, it is very nice. And for some time, it was very fashionable to do denotational semantics. I think, meanwhile, it has more or less completely disappeared from the curriculum. Have you ever seen denotational semantics of something? You have seen? So there, in the old days, there you had courses where you were shown that small step and there's something like big step operational semantics are the same, are equivalent to denotational semantics and things like that. But that is so it is one form how to denote the meaning of programs, to formalize meaning of programs. It is not so fashionable, because it is it only captures certain aspects of programming. It does not capture things like concurrency. So as soon as you have concurrency, then you have something like non-deterministic behavior. A program may have different outcomes. Then you might have interaction with users. All that cannot be nicely captured by denotational semantics. So therefore, it is a bit it is out of fashion in some sense. But it here for such kind of proving such kind of programs correct, it is the method of choice. Yeah. So there, this we will not do the formalization of this denotational semantics, but I only want to say it has a similar form. You write down the equations as we have done, only that you do not compute over 0, 1, but you compute over real values. And real values are, for example, the integers extended with the bottom symbol. Bottom for non-termination and or not yet terminated, and numbers for results. So this is not a complete lattice, but it is a complete partial order in that sense that if you have in some sense, in denotational semantics, the fixed point evaluation will kind of follow an increasing chain of values. So therefore, it's not necessary that you combine 1 and 2 into a top element, but in a denotational semantics, a real program execution will for some time have not yet reached some value, and at some point will reach a value, and then it's only one value. So it's only set. So therefore, this kind of set, so these kind of thing, 1, 2, 3, 4, and the bottom element below, that is something which is a partial order with which denotational semantics can work. Yeah. So once again, you only need that least upper bounds exists for chains of values and not for arbitrary sets of values. Okay. Now, and that's so in that sense, you write down your fixed point equation, but now over this kind of partial ordering, and then one can say, okay, there's also something like, you can still apply kind of Kleene's fixed point, theorem, and that means there is something like a least solution. And the only thing is what you have to do that during fixed point iteration, something like a description relation is preserved. And now we may kind of consider what kind of description relation we might have between 0 and 1 and values. And so then 0 describes only the bottom value. So this means definite non-termination, and 1 describes everything. And I should say, I missed it. Set describes not only set, but set and also the bottom element. Yeah, okay. And, yeah. And now, that is okay. So that was so once again, the bottom line is, if you have these programs without higher order functions and data structures, only integers or only basic values, then this kind of strictness analysis works nicely, and the optimization also works nicely. The question is, what happens if we want to have data structures, and with programs without data structures are kind of a little bit boring. So now, then we have a kind of a problem, because then it's not so the question, will a function, so you have a, think of a list, now the head function. So the head function, so clearly, if the, so for the head function to terminate, it is not required that the whole list, the evaluation of the full list has terminated, because it may be an infinite list. The only thing what is required is that the top constructor has terminated, and the left the first element in the list is there. So head, the function head, only accesses the first element of the list, and the rest is ignored. And also length, the length function, if you apply that to a list, then it's also not required that the whole list is evaluated, but only that the backbone of the list is there. The elements in the list may not have been, there may be closures there. They are simply not looked at. And then there is something, but then there is also something, if you return a list, like, for example, so length returns a number. So that's okay. So you look at the number, and then you may wonder, will I look at the length, or will I not look at the length? But what happens if the result of a function, if the result of a function itself is something like a list? And now you may wonder, will I look at the full list, or will I only look at parts of it? Now, so you may think of, I have a sorting routine. And then the question is, will I look at the full result, or will I only look at the first element of the sorted list? So this is like computing the max function. And then the sorting algorithm may differ. So sorting algorithms may differ in how much they compute. So in that sense, there is kind of, the termination behavior of these functions, termination properties are more subtle. They are more kind of, there's a variety of termination behaviors of as soon as I have data structures, and we somehow have to provide techniques which are can deal with that, and that is what we will do what we will do next. But before that, we will now enrich our, in order to deal. So we have to cope with these different variations of termination behaviors. That is one thing, and the other thing is we need to extend our language so that we kind of have some data structures. So I add now lists. So here are the lists. And we have a match. And here's the match. And then we have pairs, perhaps, and we can also decompose pairs. So that is what we add to our language. And then we may start to reason about strictness properties of such programs. And that is what we discuss next week. And so here on the we start with this top strictness, but that I will explain next Wednesday. So for today, thank you very much for your attention, and we meet again on Wednesday.